Historically, if you peered into the corporate finance machinery of, well, almost any mid to large tier company, the credit and collections department was, let's be brutally honest here, it was a bit of an afterthought.
Oh, absolutely. Very much a back office function.
Right. It was that sleepy sort of department, usually tucked away in a windowless corner somewhere, surrounded by metal filing cabinets.
Yeah.
And it only really sprang into action a week or so after the month-end close. I mean, if we want an analogy, the old school credit controller was essentially the janitor.
That is a brilliant way of putting it. Yeah, the cleanup crew.
Exactly. They swept up after the corporate party had already finished, collecting the empty bottles and mopping the floors, ringing up clients to ask politely for a check that was already 3 weeks late.
Which is a terrible position to be
It
in.
really is. But if you look at the landscape across Australia and New Zealand right now in 2026, that picture is entirely unrecognizable.
Completely transformed.
That credit controller is no longer the janitor. They are the bouncer, standing at the front door, checking IDs, scanning the crowd, and stopping the trouble before the party even starts.
They have to be, because today they are the absolute front line of corporate survival.
Which brings us nicely to our topic. Welcome to this deep dive. Today, we are exploring the 2026 landscape of credit, collections, and working capital across Australia and New Zealand. And to do this, for you listening at home or on the commute, we are synthesizing a rather intimidating stack of research.
It's a massive amount of data, isn't it?
It really is. We are pulling operational insights from the Australian Institute of Credit Management, the AICM, alongside the heavy-hitting commercial bureaus.
Right, so we're talking Creditor Watch, Illion, Equifax.
Yes, and the massive new disruptor on the block, Credit Protect. We'll also be examining the frontline reality from recovery firms like RMA Group, Capital Credit Solutions, and AMPAC.
Which is where the rubber really meets the road.
Spot on. And to frame all of that, we have the strategic advisory research from KPMG, PwC, and McKinsey. So we're taking all of this intelligence and figuring out exactly how businesses are keeping the lights on right now.
Keeping the lights on is the operative phrase there, I think, because the consensus across all this advisory research is that managing debtors is no longer an administrative chore. It is a critical board-level liquidity discipline.
It's moved right at the chain of command.
Oh, absolutely. We have fully exited the era of cheap money, 0% interest rates, and forgiving debtor markets.
The easy days are well and truly over.
They are. Finance leaders are now operating in an environment where they have to fiercely protect their margins. They have to utilize data in ways they simply didn't have to 5 years ago.
And quite often with a much leaner headcount, let's not forget.
Exactly, doing more with less. And if you are running a business today, or even if you're just trying to understand where the economy is actually heading, this shift matters immensely to you.
Because profit on a spreadsheet isn't the whole story, is it?
Not at all. That lovely black ink on a profit and loss statement means absolutely nothing if it does not translate into physical cash in your bank account.
Right.
The gap between what a company claims to have made on paper and the real cash it can actually deploy to pay its own bills, that gap is exactly where the current macroeconomic pressure is showing up first. It is the canary in the coal mine.
So before we delve into the solutions, into how businesses are actually plugging these holes in their cash flow, we need to understand the sheer scale of the macroeconomic storm that is battering Australia and New Zealand right now.
And it is a storm.
The numbers in this research are frankly staggering. Let's look at the core data from the Australian Securities and Investments Commission, ASIC. In the 2024 to 2025 financial year, they reported that 14,722 companies entered external administration in Australia.
Over 14,000 businesses failing in a single year. Just let that sink in for a moment.
It's massive. And when you look at the year-on-year trajectory, it's a 33.2% jump from the previous year.
Which is a terrifying acceleration. Now, the recent data suggests this rate has moderated slightly, leveling out at around 1,200 to 1,300 insolvencies per month.
Which is still incredibly high.
Exactly. The absolute volume remains at a historically elevated plateau. We are not looking at a momentary spike here. We are looking at a sustained period of corporate failure.
And across the Tasman in New Zealand, the picture is equally grim, if not more so in historical terms.
Oh, the New Zealand data is fascinating.
Right, so Deloitte's New Zealand Insolvency Trends 2025 report, which analyzes their company's office data, recorded 3,080 formal corporate insolvency appointments in 2025.
And in the context of the New Zealand economy, which is obviously smaller, a 12% year-on-year increase is massive.
Yeah, but the real headline there is that this is the highest level of formal appointments seen in 15 years. they noted a particularly vicious spike in fourth quarter appointment activity.
We really need to unpack the mechanics of this. For everyone listening, you have to ask, why this specific volume right now?
And what is the trigger?
We are looking at a toxic convergence of pressures. On one side, you have significantly higher funding costs. If a business needs a bridge loan or an overdraft to cover a cash flow gap, the interest they are paying on that facility today is crippling compared to the early 2020s.
Because money isn't virtually free anymore.
Precisely. And on the other side, you have severely depressed consumer demand. When consumers tighten their belts, revenue drops. But a company's fixed operating costs, the rent, the baseline payroll, the insurance, they remain stubbornly high.
So the margins don't just get squeezed, they evaporate entirely.
They vanish.
Now, we always hear about construction and hospitality taking the first hit. It's almost a cliche at this point, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
A building firm collapses because the price of timber and steel skyrocketed while they were locked into a fixed price contract.
A classic scenario.
Or a restaurant chain goes into administration because discretionary spending dried up and people just stopped buying $20 cocktails on a Tuesday night.
Exactly. Those sectors were the first dominoes, yes. But the critical development, and this is highlighted brilliantly by Creditor Watch's data, is that the stress is no longer contained there.
It's spreading.
It is operating like a contagion. The pressure has moved deep into transport, into retail, and even into essential services.
Which is alarming.
Very. Because when you see elevated failure rates in transport and logistics, the hauliers moving goods around the country, you know the systemic pressure is severe.
Because they're usually the resilient ones.
Exactly. Those are typically the businesses that weather economic storms the best. They are the circulatory system of the economy. If the hauliers are going to the wall, the infection has reached the vital organs.
Let me challenge this narrative for a moment, because if you're listening to this, you might be thinking the exact same thing. We have known about higher interest rates for a long time.
Fair point.
Central banks began hiking rates years ago. The cost of living crisis isn't exactly breaking news on the BBC. So why on earth are we seeing a 15-year high in New Zealand, insolvencies specifically in 2025 and stretching into 2026?
That's a great question.
Shouldn't these businesses have adapted to the higher rate environment by now? Surely the weak ones would have failed 2 years ago and the survivors would have restructured their debts, cut their overheads, and just moved on. Why are we seeing this delayed explosion now?
You are hitting on a crucial concept that economists and credit professionals refer to as the lag effect.
The lag effect.
Because insolvency is rarely a sudden cardiac arrest. It is a slow, progressive, wasting disease. When funding costs rise and demand drops, a company doesn't just hand the keys to the administrator the following week.
No, they try to fight it.
Exactly. First, they burn through their existing cash reserves. Those might be reserves built up during the pandemic stimulus years or simply retained earnings from better trading periods.
So they basically run on fumes. They use up their savings account just to make payroll.
Spot on. And when the cash reserves run completely dry, they still don't immediately go into administration. Instead, they start using their supply chain as a covert, unauthorized overdraft facility.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. An invoice from a supplier that they traditionally paid in 30 days, they stretch it to 45 days.
Just to keep the cash in their own account.
Precisely. Then they push it to 60 days. They might manage to secure an extended line of credit from a secondary lender or renegotiate terms with the tax office. They survive by aggressively juggling who gets paid and who is made to wait.
So they become masters of delaying tactics.
They have to be. And this juggling act can go on for 12, 18, sometimes even 24 months.
So the dam doesn't burst all at once. It sustains hundreds of tiny fractures over a year and a half until the structural integrity completely gives way.
That's exactly it. The collapse happens when they simply run out of entities willing to extend them credit. When the suppliers put them on stop, when the bank refuses the extension, the game is up.
And the data shows us this breaking point, right?
It does. The ultimate leading indicator that a business has reached this breaking point is a metric the industry calls long-dated arrears.
Let's define long-dated arrears clearly for you listening, because this is where the theory turns into hard data.
Right. So long-dated arrears refer to invoices that have slipped past 60 days overdue. And crucially, that is not 60 days from the invoice date. It is 60 days past the agreed due date.
Oh, so they might have had 30 days to pay, and now it's 60 days past that. So we're talking 90 days total.
Exactly. Creditor Watch data highlights that late business-to-business payments have hit multi-year highs, with a rapidly growing share of invoices slipping into this 60-plus days overdue category.
Which is terrifying for the supplier.
Absolutely, because when an invoice gets that old, it is no longer an administrative oversight. The invoice isn't lost in the post, the accounts payable clerk isn't just on holiday, it is a fundamental structural liquidity crisis.
They just don't have the cash.
The company simply does not have the money to pay. This is why long-dated arrears are the most reliable early warning siren of impending insolvency. They often flash months before a formal administrator is actually appointed.
So the lag effect simply means it takes 2 years for a struggling business to bleed out completely. And 2025 and 2026 are the years where the bleeding finally stops and the business dies.
I'm afraid so.
That paints an incredibly vivid, if somewhat bleak, picture. The insolvencies are just the final visible symptom of a sickness that has been developing quietly in the background for years.
Exactly.
Which transitions us perfectly into how the major advisory firms view this. Because if insolvencies are the terminal stage, working capital is the disease itself.
Spot on.
Let's look at how KPMG, PwC, and McKinsey diagnose this. They view working capital not just as a finance metric, but as a core survival tool.
This is where the conversation shifts from observing the macroeconomic wreckage to understanding the internal mechanics of corporate survival. Because credit and collections do not operate in a vacuum.
No, they're part of a bigger machine.
They sit squarely inside the wider working capital ecosystem of a business.
Let's bring in the KPMG data here, because their working capital trends analysis is incredibly revealing. And they didn't just survey a handful of local corner shops. They analyzed over 500 listed Australian public companies.
Huge data sets. Massive publicly traded entities.
Exactly. And KPMG found that the national cash conversion cycle blew out from 58 days in the 2021 financial year, peaking at a massive 71 days in FY24, before easing just slightly to 62 days in FY25.
We really should break down the cash conversion cycle, or CCC, because it is the ultimate measure of a company's operational efficiency.
Let's do it.
The CCC is a metric that expresses the length of time in days that it takes for a company to convert its investments in inventory and other resources into cash flows from sales.
Right. So to put it simply, from the moment you spend a pound or a dollar, in this case, buying raw materials to manufacture a product, to the moment you actually get that dollar back from the customer who bought the finished product, how many days have passed?
Exactly. So if you're a mid-sized manufacturing firm in FY21, it took you 58 days to turn your investments back into cash. By FY24, you were waiting 71 days.
That is almost two whole extra weeks where your cash is just trapped.
Completely trapped. It's trapped in warehouses as unsold stock, or it's trapped in the ether as unpaid invoices sitting on your clients' desks.
And you can't use that cash for anything else. You can't use it to pay your own staff. You can't use it to invest in new machinery. And you certainly can't distribute it as profit to shareholders. It's dead capital.
Dead capital is the perfect phrase. And while it eased slightly to 62 days in FY25, it remains significantly degraded compared to 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, KPMG broke this down further. They isolated a specific component of this cycle, days sales outstanding, or DSO.
Famous DSO.
This measures purely how long it takes a company to collect payment after making a sale. And KPMG found that DSO has remained stubbornly stuck at around 46 to 47 days across this entire five-year period.
A stubborn DSO of 46 days?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about days sales outstanding, like human blood pressure.
I like this analogy.
Well, if your blood pressure is slightly elevated, you don't necessarily have a heart attack tomorrow, do you?
Yeah, you feel fine.
Right, you can walk around, go to work, feel entirely normal.
Mm-hmm.
But if you leave your blood pressure elevated for years at a time, it silently damages your arteries. It weakens the walls of your heart. It strains your entire cardiovascular system until one day you suffer a sudden catastrophic event.
That is exactly how it works.
A stubbornly high DSO is identical. It means a company is perpetually waiting a month and a half to get paid for work it has already completed. It silently damages the liquidity of the business, draining its resilience month after month until a market shock happens, like a sudden interest rate hike or a supply chain collapse, and the business just folds.
That analogy is highly accurate because the damage is completely systemic. And this is precisely what PwC Australia's 2026 CFO agenda is warning against.
What are they saying specifically?
Their research highlights a very real danger that chief financial officers are beginning to accept these longer collection cycles as a benign new normal.
Oh, complacency.
Exactly. PwC specifically warns that a rising or stubbornly high DSO is a glaring signal of weakening payment morale across the market.
Payment morale. That is a brilliant phrase. It perfectly captures the psychological shift in B2B transactions.
It really does.
It's the normalization of paying late. It's the accounts payable manager at a large corporation receiving an invoice on strict 30-day terms and thinking, well, the industry standard has slipped to 45 days and our own cash flow is tight, so I'm just going to hold on to this for another 2 weeks. What are they actually going to do about it? Sue us over a $20,000 invoice.
And they know you won't. And that psychological shift creates a vicious self-perpetuating cycle.
Because it rolls downhill.
Exactly. When Company A delays payment to Company B is now short on cash, which forces them to delay payment to their own supplier, Company C. The contagion spreads down the supply chain.
Which brings us to a frankly astonishing metric from the KPMG analysis. Days payable outstanding, or DPO.
Yes, the other side of the coin. This measures how long a company takes to pay its own bills. KPMG found the DPO increased to around 52 days in FY25.
52 days.
Now, wait a minute. Let's pause on that for you listening, because this seems to fly in the face of everything the government has been trying to achieve down under.
It does seem contradictory.
Australia introduced the Payment Times Reporting Act 2020. This was a major, highly publicized piece of federal legislation. Its entire purpose was to name and shame large businesses that pay their small business suppliers late.
Yes. The government wanted to force big companies to pay faster to protect the SME sector.
So if this legislation exists, and these massive companies are supposed to be behaving themselves, how on earth is DPO increasing to 52 days? How is the average big business taking almost 2 months to pay their bills?
It reveals the harsh reality of corporate power dynamics in a high interest rate environment.
Right.
Despite the policy attention, despite the regulatory pressure of the Payment Times Reporting Act, large companies are ruthlessly protecting their own cash reserves.
Because cash is king.
Always. Consider the mathematics of it. If a large corporate has a weighted average cost of capital of, say, 8 or 9%, every single day they can hold on to their cash generates a tangible financial value for them.
It's basically free money for them.
Exactly. They look at the legislation and they look at their balance sheet and they make a calculated decision. They stretch their payment terms to the absolute legal limit and quite often well beyond it.
Gambling that the smaller supplier won't complain.
Spot on. They gamble that the smaller supplier won't raise a fuss out of fear of losing the contract entirely.
So essentially, these massive publicly listed companies are using their smallest suppliers as a free, interest-free line of credit. I mean, why would a massive corporate borrow from a bank at 9% when they can just withhold payment from their independent IT consultant or their commercial cleaning contractor for an extra 20 days entirely for free?
That is exactly the dynamic. It is commercially rational from the perspective of the large corporate, even if it is devastating for the SME.
It's quite brutal.
It is. The legislation acts somewhat like a speed limit on a motorway with no speed cameras. People know the rule is there, but without severe immediate enforcement, the commercial incentive to speed is just too great.
That makes a lot of sense.
And this brings us to McKinsey's strategic perspective on the matter. McKinsey's research consistently argues that cash management, and specifically working capital, can no longer be a siloed function belonging solely to the finance department.
It can't just be the credit controller's problem anymore.
Precisely. If you want to fix these issues, it has to be a cross-functional lever.
So what does that actually look like in practice, having sales, operations, and finance all in lockstep?
It means breaking down the traditional enmity between departments.
Right.
Historically, a sales director is incentivized entirely by revenue volume. They want to sell to anyone with a pulse to hit their commission targets, right?
Of course.
And the credit manager is incentivized by risk reduction. They want to block any deal that looks even slightly risky.
They're naturally at odds.
Exactly. But McKinsey notes that top-performing companies use data to bridge this gap. They segment customers collaboratively, they prioritize at-risk accounts, and they tighten dispute management together. The advisory consensus is clear. Poor working capital is a systemic disease, and treating it requires the whole organization to change its behavior, from the CEO right down to the junior sales rep.
So if poor working capital is the disease, and we know it's spreading rapidly, how do businesses protect themselves before the infection takes hold?
That is the million-dollar question.
Which brings us to the data providers. If working capital is the disease, data is the early screening test. The old days of running a basic static credit check when you first onboard a new client, filing it away in a drawer and never looking at it again, those days are completely obsolete.
A static credit check is utterly useless today.
Why? Because things change too fast.
Exactly. It tells you what a company's financial health looked like 3 months ago. In the current economic climate, a company's liquidity position can deteriorate from healthy to fatally compromised in the space of 6 weeks.
Wow, 6 weeks.
Easily. Continuous proactive monitoring is the only viable defense, and the landscape of data providers in Australia and New Zealand has evolved dramatically to meet this need. We are looking at a highly sophisticated AI-driven bureau battlefield.
Let's map out the key players and what they are bringing to the table in 2026, because the sophistication of these tools is wild. For you listening, if you're not using some of this, you are flying blind. First up, we have Creditor Watch.
Yes.
As we mentioned, they publish some of the most closely watched insolvency data sets in the market. But for a credit manager on the ground, their real power lies in their focus on forward-looking early warning signals. Specifically, they track trade payment defaults and ATO, that's the Australian Taxation Office tax defaults.
Monitoring ATO tax defaults is arguably the single most important proactive step a credit team can take right now. Creditor Watch emphasizes that this needs to be monitored constantly, monthly, at an absolute minimum.
Let's really dig into the mechanics of this. Why is a tax default the ultimate red flag? I mean, why is it more terrifying than a company missing a payment to their stationery supplier or their PR agency?
It comes down to the grim hierarchy of corporate survival.
Okay, paint me a picture.
Think about the timeline of a company rapidly running out of cash. It's Thursday afternoon. The directors are sitting in a boardroom, and they know they only have $50,000 left in the bank, but they have $100,000 in bills due tomorrow.
A nightmare scenario.
They have to make agonizing choices about who gets paid. First, they will always pay their employees. If they don't make payroll on Friday, the staff walk out, tools are downed, and the business effectively dies that afternoon.
Right. Payroll is sacred. You don't mess with people's wages.
Exactly. Next, they look at their essential trade suppliers. The entities providing the raw materials or inventory they need to actually generate revenue next week.
The absolute essentials.
Yes. If you run a logistics company, you absolutely have to pay your fuel supplier. Otherwise, your trucks don't start on Monday. If you run a restaurant, you have to pay the meat supplier.
Makes total sense.
So who is left at the very bottom of that priority list? The entity that does not immediately turn the lights off or stop supplying you with goods if you miss a payment. And that is the tax office.
Ah. Because the ATO isn't going to rock up on Monday morning and refuse to let your staff into the building.
Precisely. The ATO is often treated as the lender of last resort by struggling businesses.
That's fascinating.
Directors will quietly defer their GST payments or their PAYG withholding tax simply to keep cash in the business to pay wages and essential suppliers.
Just buying time.
Exactly. So if you are a supplier and your bureau platform pings you with an alert that your client has just registered an ATO tax default, that is a blaring, flashing siren.
Right, because it means they've burned through everything else.
It tells you unequivocally that they have exhausted their cash reserves, they are prioritizing survival costs, and if they haven't stopped paying you yet, you are almost certainly next on the chopping block.
That perfectly illustrates why proactive, real-time monitoring is crucial. You need to know they've defaulted on their taxes before they default on your invoice.
Absolutely.
Okay, so alongside Creditor Watch, we have Illion, who offer a platform called Illion Direct. Now, their focus seems to be heavily on portfolio monitoring and predictive late payment scoring, specifically tailored for complex, multi-entity corporate groups.
Illion is addressing a very specific structural risk here. In the modern corporate world, you rarely deal with a single, simple entity.
No, it's always a maze of holding companies and subsidiaries.
Exactly. You deal with a parent company that has 20 different subsidiary companies sitting underneath it. Illion helps untangle that web.
Which stops you from getting caught out by a technicality.
It prevents a scenario where your credit controller thinks an account is safe because subsidiary A is paying its invoices on time, completely missing the fact that subsidiary B and the parent company itself are severely distressed.
Right, they might be facing lawsuits and are about to pull the entire corporate structure down into administration.
Exactly. It provides holistic visibility across the entire group.
Brilliant. Then we have Equifax and their Debtor IQ platform. This is a fascinating approach because it blends external bureau data with a company's own internal receivables ledger.
Yes, the blending is key.
They take the macro data of what's happening in the broader economy, and they smash it together with your internal accounting data to benchmark how your customers are behaving compared to industry averages.
It provides essential context.
How so?
Well, imagine you have a customer who is consistently paying you 15 days late. The immediate assumption is that the customer is in financial distress, right?
Naturally. You assume they're running out of cash.
But Equifax's tool allows you to look at the broader market. If the data shows that this customer is paying everyone else in the market on time, and they are only paying you 15 days late, then the problem isn't their liquidity.
Oh.
The problem is your internal process.
That's a huge revelation.
Maybe your invoices are confusing, or your terms aren't clear, or your sales rep made a verbal side deal you don't know about. It allows CFOs to see where internal process failures are contributing to delayed cash, rather than just blaming the customer.
That is incredibly powerful. And then we have the disruptor. In June 2025, a major new player entered the battlefield, Credit Protect.
Yes, this is a really interesting story.
It is. It was founded by Colin Torter, a highly successful fintech entrepreneur who actually founded Creditor Watch originally, as well as Avenue Bank. Credit Protect entered the market backed by strategic investment and data support from Experian, which is obviously a global heavyweight in credit data.
What makes Credit Protect compelling is their target market and their technological methodology.
Right. They're going after the smaller guys, aren't they?
Porter launched it squarely at the SME market, small and medium-sized enterprises. Historically, robust enterprise-grade credit intelligence was too complex and far too expensive for a local plumbing supply business or a mid-sized marketing agency to access.
It was reserved for the big end of town.
Exactly. Credit Protect aimed to strip away that legacy complexity. They are using an AI-optimized platform to give SMEs access to top-tier data at an affordable price point.
So AI is actively generating sophisticated credit intelligence for small businesses. It pulls in alien commercial data, Australian business register records, court judgments, and those crucial ATO tax defaults we just discussed.
All of it.
And significantly, it's approved for use with leading trade credit insurers like QBE, Alliance Trade, and Atradius. It really proves that powerful credit decisioning is becoming faster, highly digital, and accessible to companies that don't have a massive 50-person enterprise finance function.
The technological barrier to entry for robust credit checking has effectively collapsed. The tools are available to everyone.
Okay, I have to jump in here and push back on this entire premise. Go on, because I'm listening to this. And for you at home, you might be thinking the same thing. I'm looking at all these brilliant platforms. We have Creditor Watch, tracking taxes in real time, Ilion untangling massive corporate webs, Equifax benchmarking internal ledgers, and Credit Protect, literally using AI to flash red warning signs on dashboards for SMEs.
It's an incredible arsenal of technology.
The tech is miraculous. Yet, as we established right at the start of this deep dive, 14,700 Australian companies still went under in a single year, leaving a massive trail of unpaid debts behind them.
True.
If all these systems exist, that the AI is so remarkably smart, why are so many businesses still getting caught out by bad debt? A credit manager is just staring at these AI dashboards, sipping their morning coffee, and completely ignoring the data.
You've hit the nail on the head.
Yeah.
It highlights the most crucial distinction in modern finance, the difference between possessing data and possessing a commercial process.
Explain that.
Data in isolation is completely useless. It is just numbers on a high definition screen. Let's look at a practical scenario. An AI platform sends an alert to a busy credit manager on a Tuesday afternoon saying, key customer X has just registered a $50,000 ATO tax default.
Okay.
The credit manager looks at the email, thinks, oh, that's not good. I'll need to keep a close eye on them. And then goes back to their inbox to answer 50 other pressing emails.
Because they're swamped.
Exactly. In that scenario, the data has achieved absolutely nothing.
The knowledge was there, but the action was completely absent.
Exactly. The businesses that actually survive this economic storm are the ones that integrate bureau alerts directly into their automated workflow triggers. It cannot simply exist as background noise.
So it has to force an action.
Yes. If a severe alert comes in, like a tax default or a winding up petition, it should not require a human being to ponder what to do next. The API integration should automatically trigger a system-wide credit hold on that customer's account in the company's ERP system.
Wow. Instantly.
Instantly. It should instantly notify the warehouse that no new orders are to be shipped. It should automatically lock the account until the risk is formally reassessed by management.
Take the human hesitation out of it entirely.
Yes. The massive failure we see in the market, the reason those 14,700 insolvencies hurt so many suppliers, is not a failure of AI prediction. It is a failure of execution.
Right.
Businesses possess the early warning systems, but they lack the internal governance and the sheer discipline to act on the warnings before it's too late.
So having the most advanced AI predictive model in the world is utterly useless if the human operating it lacks commercial judgment, or if the system lacks the authority to automatically pull the trigger.
Spot on.
And that transitions us beautifully into the human element of all this.
Yeah.
Because this brings us to the people holding the entire industry together, professionalizing the practice.
If data is the tool, the Australian Institute of Credit Management, the AICM, is defining the standards of the craftsmen wielding that tool.
The AICM has a long history, founded back in 1937, and they are the leading professional member body for commercial and consumer credit management in Australia.
They do excellent work.
They've been led by CEO Nick Pilavidis since 2014. Now, the research notes how heavily they emphasize education, certification, and professional standards, particularly through their Certified Credit Executive Program, the CCE accreditation. But what really stands out in this research is the AICM's push for modernization at a structural level. Specifically, Nick Pilavidis' role as the independent member on the Australia-New Zealand Electronic Invoicing Board, or AMZEIB.
That appointment is critical, and it signals a major shift in how the credit profession views its role in the broader economy.
Now, if you're listening to this and you don't work in finance, hearing phrases like master data accuracy and e-invoicing probably sounds like the most boring, mundane, administrative bureaucracy imaginable.
It does sound a bit dry, I'll admit.
It sounds like the kind of topic designed to put you to sleep at a compliance seminar. But in the context of corporate survival, it is absolutely vital. Let me give you an analogy to explain why.
Go for it.
Think about a simple typo on an invoice. Let's say you bill a client for $100,000 for a major project, but your admin team accidentally leaves off the purchase order number or spells the client's legal entity name slightly wrong. Just a tiny clerical error.
Happens all the time.
That typo seems trivial.
Yeah.
But what you have essentially just done is grant your customer a 30-day interest-free loan.
That is precisely how it plays out in the real world every single day.
Walk us through the mechanics of that. For the listener, why does a missing PO number equal a massive interest-free loan?
Put yourself in the shoes of an accounts payable clerk at a large corporation. Your job is to process thousands of invoices a week. And as we discussed with the day's payable outstanding data earlier, your CFO has instructed you to protect the company's cash flow fiercely.
Right. Hold on to the cash.
Exactly. You are actively looking for valid, compliant reasons to reject invoices. An invoice arrives for $100,000. The work has been completed perfectly. The goods have been delivered on time. But the PO number is missing.
Right. The technicality.
The clerk does not proactively pick up the phone to call you and ask for the number. They simply flag the invoice as disputed or invalid in their system and put it in the too hard basket.
And they don't even bother to tell you they've done it.
Quite often they do not. 30 days pass, the invoice due date arrives, your credit controller rings them up and says, "Hi, I'm calling about the $100,000 invoice. It's due today."
What do they say?
The clerk politely replies, "Oh, I'm sorry. That invoice was invalid. It was missing a PO number, so it couldn't be processed. You need to reissue it."
Oh, goodness.
So your team scrambles, fixes the typo, and reissues the invoice with today's date. And the 30-day payment clock starts all over again.
That is infuriating.
You have just waited 60 days for money you should have had in 30, all because of a tiny administrative error. This directly inflates the day's sales outstanding metrics we discussed earlier. It silently bleeds cash from the business.
So poor invoicing literally damages the structural liquidity of the company.
It does.
Huh?
Which is why the AICM's work on e-invoicing is not just an IT project or a government digitization initiative. It is a commercial imperative.
Because it fixes the data at the source.
Exactly. E-invoicing essentially removes the human error component. When systems talk directly to systems via an e-invoicing network, data matches perfectly. The opportunity for a customer to use an administrative error as a tactical delay strategy is completely eliminated.
That makes total sense. Better administration equals faster cash conversion.
Absolutely. This is the structural modernization that leaders like Pilavidis are championing.
And it's why those professional standards are so vital. The research mentions the AICM National Conference, which has run for over 20 years. The 2026 event is in Brisbane, themed Credit in Motion, Lead the Change, and features Australia's only credit-specific trade expo.
A huge networking and educational event.
Then there's the Australian Credit Forum, established way back in the early 1970s, bringing senior professionals together to exchange ideas. For employers looking to hire, active participation in these forums is a massive green flag, isn't it?
Oh, massively. It shows a credit leader is current, connected, and serious about understanding these underlying structural standards rather than just knowing how to send a final notice letter.
It separates the true professionals who understand the entire working capital lifecycle, from the moment an order is placed to the moment the cash is reconciled, from the generalists who merely know how to dial a phone and demand money.
Spot on.
Let's be entirely realistic, though. What happens when the predictive data fails? The AI didn't catch the risk? The master data is flawless, the e-invoice is completely perfect, but the client still doesn't pay.
Ah, the sharp end of the stick.
Because they just can't, or they outright refuse to. That brings us to debt recovery.
Yeah.
And spoiler alert, it is no longer about angry people yelling on the phone or sending heavies around with baseball bats.
Thank goodness. The evolution of debt collection is perhaps one of the most fascinating paradigm shifts in this entire deep dive.
Tell me about it.
The traditional adversarial model of debt recovery, the tough guy on the phone making threats, is being completely dismantled. It is being rebuilt around concepts that seem almost counterintuitive to the old way of doing things.
Like what?
Well, empathy, ethics, and highly sophisticated AI.
The research highlights three major players that illustrate this evolution perfectly. Let's start with ARA Group, which is now part of Credit Clear Limited, an ASX-listed company trading under the ticker CCR. Led by Andrew Smith.
A very prominent operation.
And ASIF. They are a huge hybrid operation. We are talking FY25 revenue of $46.9 million with underlying EBITDA up 76%. They are scaling rapidly, and their published positioning is fascinating.
How so?
Well, they utilize a digital-first method that combines AI, behavioral analytics, and, here's the key word, empathy. They explicitly aim to protect both the collection outcome and the client's brand reputation.
That brand reputation aspect is massive for large corporates. A major bank or a telecommunications giant cannot afford to have rogue, aggressive debt collectors harassing vulnerable customers.
The PR disaster would be huge.
Exactly. The reputational damage in the press and the regulatory blowback from ombudsmen are simply too severe.
Then we have Capital Credit Solutions, led by Trent Vieira. They focus on debt acquisition and mercantile agency recovery. They operate on a strict no collection, no commission basis.
Which really aligns their incentives with the client.
Exactly. And they heavily emphasize ethical engagement, hardship identification, and compliant communications over purely adversarial recovery.
Their underlying philosophy is actually about prevention, establishing strong terms of trade and solid director guarantees from day one.
Meaning the best recovery is the debt that never becomes a problem in the first place.
A very sound structural philosophy. Absolutely.
And thirdly, AMPAC Debt Recovery, led by Mark Logue, who actually holds that MICM credential from the AICM, reinforcing those professional standards we just talked about. AMPAC is a tech-driven agency operating for over 30 years, utilizing things like the IA's Global Collection Network for a complex international recovery.
Right, representing the move away from manual chasing toward platform-led, sophisticated B2B collections.
So we have three distinct but aligned models. The listed digital hybrid scaling rapidly through technology, the ethical mercantile agency focusing on prevention and early hardship identification, and the established tech-driven B2B specialist.
All pushing the industry forward.
Right, but I am going to lean in with some heavy skepticism here.
I thought you might.
Because I'm reading these buzzwords, digital empathy, ethical engagement, behavioral analytics. Let's be deeply cynical for a second. We just talked about 14,700 businesses going into administration.
We did.
If I am dealing with a bankrupt construction firm that owes my manufacturing company a $50,000 bill, does being polite and having an AI send them a gentle, empathetic text message actually get me my 50 grand? Or is all this empathy talk just corporate PR spin to make the gritty, unpleasant business of debt collection sound nicer for ESG reports?
It is a completely valid skepticism. It really is. But it fundamentally misunderstands the commercial reality of insolvency.
Enlighten me.
You have to arrive at a profound realization, an adversarial, aggressive approach. Yelling on the phone, threatening legal action, taking a hardline, uncompromising stance yields exactly $0 from a client that is genuinely functionally bankrupt.
Because you can't squeeze blood from a stone.
Exactly.
If the money isn't there, yelling won't conjure it into existence.
Precisely. If a company goes into formal liquidation, unsecured trade creditors, the everyday suppliers, are at the very bottom of the priority list.
Who gets paid first?
The secured creditors, like the banks, take their secured assets. The employees take their mandated entitlements. The liquidators take their incredibly substantial fees. And the unsecured trade supplier is left fighting over a few pennies on the pound if they get anything at all.
Which is usually nothing.
The statistical reality is that once formal insolvency hits, your $50,000 debt is almost certainly written off entirely. Therefore, empathy in 2026 collections isn't about being soft or nice or fulfilling a corporate social responsibility quota.
What is it then?
It is a highly calculated, ruthlessly pragmatic commercial strategy.
Explain how empathy is ruthless. That sounds like an oxymoron. How does being nice get you paid?
It is ruthless because its sole singular objective is maximizing financial recovery before the window of opportunity slams shut. By using AI and behavioral analytics to identify financial hardship early, before the liquidators are called in, you can engage with the debtor digitally. Crucially, you do this without the shame, the embarrassment, and the defensive barriers that invariably arise when a distressed business owner has to talk to an aggressive human debt collector on the phone.
Because people put their walls up.
Exactly. You offer them digital pathways to restructure their debt silently. The AI might send a message saying, "We can see your account is severely overdue. We understand cash flow is tight. Instead of demanding the full $50,000 today, which we know you don't have, can you commit to paying $5,000 a week for the next 10 weeks through this secure, automated digital portal?"
And because they aren't embarrassed, and because the pathway is literally just clicking a button on their phone, they agree to it.
Yes. They sign up to the automated payment plan, and maybe you recover $35,000 over 7 weeks before they eventually do collapse.
That's brilliant.
From a pure commercial standpoint, recovering $35,000 through calculated empathy is infinitely superior to recovering $0 through aggressive posturing. Empathy allows creditors to recover principal that would otherwise be entirely lost in a formal liquidation.
The AI simply removes the human friction and the crippling shame from the repayment process.
Spot on. It makes it easy for them to give you whatever cash they do have left.
That completely flips the narrative. Empathy isn't a moral stance here. It's a tool for superior financial extraction in a highly distressed market.
It really is.
Which leads us to the final piece of this puzzle.
Yeah.
Because to run these AI systems, to manage these cross-functional relationships with sales and operations, and to execute this nuanced, calculated empathy, you need a completely new breed of professional.
You absolutely do.
And according to the research, finding them right now is incredibly difficult. We have a massive talent squeeze.
The talent squeeze is severe. We are looking at insights from Byron Thomas Recruitment, who specialize in executive search and finance hiring across Australia and New Zealand. Their data shows that demand for highly skilled credit professionals is surging across the board.
But they're surging for very specific hybrid roles. The research highlights the need for credit managers with deep trade credit insurance experience.
Yes, that's crucial.
They need credit analysts who don't just look at a static balance sheet, but who can interpret macro sector risk indicators. Understanding how a spike in fuel prices impacts a logistics client's ability to pay in 3 months' time.
Forward-looking analysis.
And crucially, they're looking for group CFOs and financial controllers who actually own working capital rather than just reporting on it to the board at the end of the month.
That distinction between owning and reporting is the crux of the modern finance mandate. The research explicitly outlines what good looks like in 2026.
Break that down for us.
Well, it means having clear, robust credit policies that are applied consistently across every division of the business. It means earlier intervention managing disputes inside the active ledger cycle, resolving that missing PO number at day 15, not waiting until a debt is 90 days overdue to look into it.
Getting ahead of it.
Exactly. It means conducting proactive, data-led portfolio reviews using all the bureau intelligence we discussed, and perhaps most importantly, having incredibly strong collaborative communication with the sales team.
Let's focus on that dynamic with the sales team, because historically, the sales team and the credit team are mortal enemies.
They often are, yes.
Sales wants to sell to absolutely anyone to hit their commission targets and buy a new car. And credit wants to block any deal that looks slightly risky. How does the 2026 credit leader actually handle that tension without stalling the company's growth?
The modern credit professional must operate as a diplomat.
A diplomat.
Yes. They have to possess the commercial acumen to sit down with a commission-hungry sales director and explain the risk logically without becoming a stubborn blocker to business growth.
Give me an example of how that plays out.
Right. Imagine a scenario. A sales rep brings in a massive, lucrative new client. It's the deal of the quarter. But the Credit Protect AI dashboard is flashing red because that client has recent ATO tax defaults.
The siren is going off.
The old school credit manager would just look at the red light, stamp the file rejected, and walk away, infuriating the sales team.
And losing the revenue.
Exactly. The modern credit diplomat takes a different approach. They say to the sales director, "We absolutely want this revenue, but the data shows a high risk of insolvency within 6 months. So we are going to say yes to the deal, but we are structuring it bespoke."
How so?
They pay 50% upfront before we ship anything, and the remainder is on strict 14-day terms, fully backed by a director's personal guarantee.
Brilliant.
They facilitate the business growth, they get the revenue on the books, but they structurally mitigate the liquidity risk.
They find a sophisticated way to get to yes, but, instead of just a flat no.
Exactly. It requires deep policy discipline, high-level data literacy, and calm commercial judgment under immense pressure.
The research poses a brilliant set of questions for CFOs to ask their teams to audit their capability. But I want to distill it down.
Go on.
If you are a CFO, a CEO, or a business owner listening to this deep dive right now, and you are wondering if your current credit team is actually equipped for the 2026 environment, how do you know?
I would suggest you ask your credit manager one highly specific scenario-based question tomorrow morning.
Okay, what is the golden question?
Walk up to their desk and ask them this. When one of our key accounts starts slowing down their payments, does your team know how to definitively tell if it's an internal process problem like a billing dispute, a temporary liquidity squeeze that the client will eventually recover from, or the early death rattle of an impending insolvency?
Process problem, temporary squeeze, or death rattle. Mm-hmm. That is an incredible framework.
Because if your team cannot confidently distinguish between those three completely different scenarios using the bureau data and the internal ledger tools at their disposal, then they are not managing credit risk. They are just blindly chasing paper.
And in a macroeconomic environment where over 14,000 businesses are collapsing annually, blindly chasing paper is a guaranteed recipe for your own company's failure.
It is the ultimate difference between the bouncer checking the IDs at the door and the janitor sweeping up the mess at 3 a.m. If they can't tell the difference between a minor administrative cash flow hiccup and a terminal tax default, they're just standing in the corner waiting with a mop.
And the cost of a weak appointment in these senior credit roles is no longer just a few annoying bad debts that you write off at the end of the year.
Oh, not at all.
It is measured in massive, irrecoverable lost cash, severe management distraction, and genuine existential risk to the entire business.
Completely. It can bring a healthy company to its knees.
Let's synthesize this incredible journey we've been on today.
It's been quite the ride.
We started by looking at the sheer carnage in the macroeconomic data, the shocking 15-year high insolvency numbers across New Zealand, and the 33% spikes in Australia, driven by the lag effect of high interest rates.
The grim reality.
We unpack the hidden, silent dangers of working capital traps, how a stubborn DSO damages your business, and how large corporates are essentially weaponizing their payment terms against smaller suppliers despite government legislation.
Which is a huge systemic issue.
We navigated the new, highly sophisticated bureau battlefield, looking at how AI tools like Credit Protect and proactive tracking of ATO defaults by Creditor Watch are completely changing the game.
Proactive, not reactive.
Exactly. We explore the evolution of collections, realizing that digital empathy from firms like Armamate Group is actually a ruthless, highly effective strategy to extract cash before liquidation hits. And finally, we looked at the intense talent war for true credit diplomats who can actually navigate this landscape and partner with sales teams.
It is a comprehensive picture of a business environment that is brutally unforgiving to those who do not adapt, but highly rewarding to those who professionalize their approach to cash.
But before we wrap up, I want to hand over to you for one final provocative thought.
Right.
We've talked extensively about how AI platforms are becoming incredibly precise at predicting failure and how digital systems are automating collections. Where does this ultimately lead us?
Well, if we extrapolate all of this to its logical extreme over the next decade, if AI becomes perfectly predictive at identifying exactly which companies will default before they even know it themselves.
Which isn't that far off.
It really isn't. And if digital systems flawlessly automate collections and instantly identify hardship, will the entire concept of trade credit for high-risk businesses eventually disappear entirely?
Wow. disappear completely.
Think about it. If the data provides total, flawless transparency, the very nature of B2B trust changes. Could we be moving toward a world where transactions between businesses require real-time digital escrow?
How would that work?
Where funds are locked in a smart contract the moment an order is placed and released the exact millisecond the e-invoice is verified, completely eliminating the 30, 60, or 90-day waiting game.
So the supplier takes absolutely zero risk.
Precisely. It would fundamentally change how economic growth is funded, moving away from supplier finance debt to pure, instantaneous transactional liquidity.
Real-time digital escrow. No more days sales outstanding. No more waiting. That would turn the entire corporate finance world upside down.
It certainly would.
It's definitely something for you to mull over as you look at your own accounts this week. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. As you go back to your business, remember our opening thought. Don't look at your receivables ledger as a dusty list of past transactions. Look at it for what it truly is in 2026, a crystal ball for your future survival.
Yeah.
Don't let your credit team be the janitors sweeping up the wreckage of bad debt. Equip them, train them, and empower them to be the bouncers keeping the trouble outside your door. Until next time.